John Kroll. We've got a treat for you today on No Limits. We're going to be talking with one of Indiana's own native sons, Hoosier writer and the star of Uncle Dan's Story Hour, Indiana's own Dan Wakefield. I know you're going to want to join this conversation, so please call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We've got a treat of a show for you today. We are going to be talking with Indiana's own Dan Wakefield. He is a novelist, a journalist, a radio star. He's been involved in films and just about every part of the cultural life of this city and country for more years probably than he cares to acknowledge. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I don't mind acknowledging. I'm amazed that I've gotten this far.
If you want to join this conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. And before we get started with the conversation, I want to urge everyone, if you enjoy conversations like this and you enjoy the kind of contribution that WFYI makes to this community, I would urge you to give to WFYI. You can do that by going to wfyi.org/give, or you can call 1-800-233-0020. My wife and I have already made our contribution. I hope you will join us. Dan, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, I just endorse everything you said.
Great. So, but I want to start this also by thanking you. You are part of a documentary that is going to air next month on WFYI's TV side about Richard Lugar. We talked last summer, I think it was,
yes,
about Senator Lugar, and you were incredibly generous with your time and your memories and all of that. So I thank you for that. But as usual, in the cutting stage, we have several great stories from you, but I think this is a great springboard to the conversation. The one we could not fit in, and it caused me great pain not to be able to include it, was the one about when your novel, Going All the Way, came out, and somebody asked then Mayor Lugar about whether he had read it or not.
Yeah, that was at a high school, Shortridge 25th High School reunion, which happened to be in 1970, and that was right after the novel came out, which a lot of people were not happy with here. And Lugar was asked, he was the speaker at that reunion, and somebody said, well, have you read Going All the Way? And Lugar said, I received it in a plain brown wrapper, which I thought was great. You know, a lot of people don't realize that he has a great sense of humor and sense of irony.
Well, you guys have had kind of a bantering relationship now for, what,
since
65 years, something like that?
Let's see. Well, we graduated from Shortridge in 1950, and we had sort of rival sports columns in the Shortridge Daily Echo. His was Shooting the Works, and mine was Sportlight. And we used to address each other as he called me Sportlight, and I called him Shooting. And in fact, we used to write letters that way. And then when he got in the Senate and I started to write a letter, Dear Shooting, I thought, you know, this probably isn't appropriate. So I started calling him Dick in letters. But anyway, he's been a very, very great and supportive friend through the years.
That was could you talk a little bit, because that's a story I think we don't hear enough about Shortridge. I mean, that I can't think of too many other schools that were the incubators of talent that Shortridge was, in addition to you and Senator Lugar, obviously Kurt Vonnegut, who was also a friend of yours. What did Shortridge do for you?
Well, I tell you, when Going All the Way came out, Vonnegut reviewed it in Life magazine, and I got a letter from another Shortridge graduate, Jim Good, who was at the time writing for Life magazine, and he said, "I read Vonnegut's review of your book. I see the Shortridge Mafia is at it again." So I told this to Vonnegut, and he said, "Well, that's good. As long as the mafia is working, let's keep it up." And Vonnegut really had a great affection for Shortridge. He talked about it all the time. In fact, the first time I met him was in 1963, and I was on a Nieman Fellowship in Journalism at Harvard for a year, and he was living on Cape Cod and making a living writing short stories, which sounds incredible today, but it was possible then. And after I had met him at this dinner of a friend's house, a writer friend said, "Oh, my God, you met Vonnegut. Did you talk about writing?" I said, "No, we talked about high school." And that was something, somehow it always came up. In fact, the last time that I saw Kurt was about a year before he died, and he in New York belonged to a very distinguished club called the Century Club, and it was, you know, made up of senators and Nobel Prize winners and all that. And Kurt said he had been at the bar of the Century Club recently, and he heard two men talking to each other, and one said, "What is this Shortridge thing? Is it some kind of fraternity?" And because he'd heard about it, talked about so much. It was a great spirit. You know, Vonnegut, he had a heroine, as it turned out, who'd been to Shortridge, 2 years older than he was, who had been in the literary club with him. And her name was Madeline Pugh. And she, in the 1940s, went with another woman. They drove to L.A. to try to get into this new field of television. And Madeline Pugh became the first head writer of the Lucy show. And when I was in L.A. in 1977, and I did a weekly radio TV show called James at 15, a weekly drama show, and I read one day in the L.A. Times that Madeline Pugh had come out of retirement to work on the a sitcom called Alice, which had fallen in the ratings, and she had brought it back to number one in the ratings. So I got her phone number from the Writers Guild, called her up and said, "Hi, this is Dan Wakefield. I went to Shortridge." So she, "Oh, good, let's have a drink." And so I got to meet her. And that was a thrill, because that was Kurt's literary hero from Shortridge.
What made Shortridge a mafia? I mean, it obviously was a very special place for all of you.
Well, yeah, that was it. It meant so much to all of us that any connection with it in later life was really became a bond, and it was. You just knew it was a special place. I don't know how it happened. I mean, it had a great faculty, but so did Crispus Attucks have a great faculty. In fact, we didn't learn all about that until years later. But Shortridge did have a special feeling. And I remember in the sectionals, that when Shortridge teams came out on the floor, everybody else booed, and we felt that was because they were jealous of us, and there was a special cheer that all the other schools in the city made when our teams came out on the floor. It was Shortridge, Shortridge, Shortridge is it. SH for Shortridge, IT for it. So I didn't say
I had
any
not
bad
heard
words
that.
Yet.
No, you didn't. you kept us out of trouble with the
yes,
FCC.
Yeah.
Good.
But it was great. It was great to be there. And, you know, WFYI TV did a great documentary a long time ago called Indy in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And they talked about the different styles of different high schools. And I remember you always knew Shortridge girls because they wore their white socks with the saddle shoes pulled up pulled up from the shoes. And the Broad Ripple girls had their white socks rolled down. So you always could identify who was a Shortridge girl and a Broad Ripple girl. So when I saw a girl with roll-down white socks, I thought, oh, too bad. won't be of interest to me.
It's interesting because that's something that, there's something, it sounds like, almost tribal.
Yeah,
about,
it was. Yeah, well, the whole, it's a tribal city. I think it still is. I'm very sorry that to see Broad Ripple closing. That was I grew up at 61st and Winthrop, and Broad Ripple was right across the Monon Railroad tracks. And I just recently went to a basketball game there, and one of my friends from school 80, who had really started playing basketball in my backyard. I had a great backboard, and he went on to be a star at Broad Ripple. And he was honored at the half of one of the Broad Ripple, one of their last games. And it's such a beautiful gem, and I just thought, oh, my God, what a waste to see this not being a school anymore. It's very sad to me.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Indiana's own Dan Wakefield today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So I want to talk a little bit, we've got about 2.5 minutes till we take a break, about first the your decision to move east, and then ultimately I'm going to try to lead us back to what brings you back to this city after a long time away.
I went to Columbia to college, and that got me to New York, and I stayed there a long time. After I got out of Columbia, I graduated to Greenwich Village and lived there. In fact, first roomed with a Shortridge friend, Ted Stieg, who'd been a great football star there, and went to Wabash, was a great friend. And that was a very great time to be in New York, the 50s and early 60s.
Yeah, you've written a great book about that, a memoir, really, of being in the 50s. When did you first sort of realize that you wanted to write for a living? Was it at Shortridge? Was it
high school? That was at school 80.
Oh, wow.
I think probably in the second or third grade. And I remember the first book really loving was The Bears of Blue River. And it was about two pioneer boys in Indiana. And then reading, I started reading books by a guy who was very popular with young boys at the time, named John R. Tunis. And he wrote all these great sports books for boys, and I loved him.
We are talking with Indiana writer, Indiana native, the star of our own Uncle Dan's Story Hour, Dan Wakefield, here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Again, my guest today is Dan Wakefield, author of Going All the Way, Starting Over, and many other books. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with one of Indiana's treasures, Dan Wakefield. He is a writer, novelist, journalist, lecturer. He is the star of Uncle Dan's Story Hour, our own program here. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So we've talked about how you went east for college, and the progression was most people think of you because of Going All the Way, Starting Over, and so of as a novelist, but before you did that, you were probably one of the what we would call today hottest long form journalists in the country.
I did write a very long form. I wrote the entire issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and it came out in March of 1968. And it was called Supernation at Peace and War. The editor had asked me to travel all around the country and write about the effect of Vietnam on this country, the effect of the Vietnam War was having on this country. So that was pretty long form. And that was great writing for The Atlantic in those days. It was great. Too.
But yeah, and that was sort of the golden age of magazines too in this country.
Yeah,
when did you make the pivot to writing fiction?
Well, I always wanted to write fiction, and I really felt the journalism was kind of warming up and training me to write fiction. I don't feel that way anymore. I think memoirs and journalism can be just as effective, but. It took me a long time to be able to write the first novel, Going All the Way, and it was a great feeling to do that. And I'm still very, very proud of that book. And by the way, that, and you mentioned New York in the 50s, which was a memoir, and those are both on ebooks now, and I have a website which is very easy to remember, danwakefield.com, and you can see all that stuff there, and information about the new show I'm doing, which I'm really excited about, which is with a great musician here, saxophone player named Sophie Fought. And she's, many people know her from her playing at the Chatterbox, and she still plays there first Wednesday of every month. But she and I are doing a really unusual show at the Jazz Kitchen called the Uncle Dan and Sophie Jam. And we have guests. Our last show was with Mark Vonnegut, Kurt's son, the doctor. And Sophie plays with her trio of Nick Tucker on bass and Kenny Phelps on drums. And those things have been really great. And we're having another Hoosier author on our next show, Kathy Day, who teaches at Ball State, and she wrote a terrific novel called The Circus in Winter, because she grew up in Peru. And when she was growing up in Peru, she discovered that Cole Porter, the great songwriter, was from Peru.
Peru as well, yeah.
And she went to her grandmother and said, well, why aren't there any statues of Cole Porter or, you know, plaques, a memorial on the wall? And her grandmother leaned over and whispered, well, he's not like the rest of us. And which meant that he was not in the same traditional sexual...
Heterosexual
grouping. But she is now, Kathy Day is writing a novel about Cole Porter's wife, who turns out to be very interesting. So she's going to come on, and June 12th, we're going to have a show with her and a show on Cole Porter. And Sophie and her trio will play Cole Porter songs at the Jazz Kitchen. So that's going to be a great event.
Do you enjoy that sort of live performance? Because most often writing is kind of a solitary thing.
Yes.
You know, that's why so many films about writers, I think, don't work all that well.
Right,
it's just
right.
hard to create drama of someone sitting at a desk for hours on end wrestling with words.
Yeah. No, I do enjoy it. And especially, I've never been any good at music. I'm not a musician, but I enjoy it, and I've always enjoyed jazz, especially from in that great era in New York in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And there was a great club there called the Five Spot. And at one time when I was living there and went to the Five Spot, the house band was Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane.
Oh, wow.
Well, you can't get any better than that. And then Charlie Mingus played there. So I've always been interested in jazz, and just recently have learned about the great jazz tradition of Indiana Avenue, which mm-hmm. had... J.J. Johnson, who I met in New York, and Wes Montgomery, right. and a whole array of great musicians. And Sophie Fought is a great saxophone player, so it's been great to be able to work with her and sort of combine words and music.
How did you get to know her?
Went to the Chatterbox, and just so happened, everybody had been telling me, you ought to go some Wednesday night. They have this great young woman saxophone player. So I went in, and the night I went in, she was playing what was one of my favorite songs from the 50s, which is I Should Care.
Mm-hmm.
And so afterwards, I went over and told her about liking that song. And then I got her a CD of June Christy, one of the great singers of the 50s, because it had that song on it. And it also, and she said, oh, there's a song I learned on there called This Will Be My Shining Hour.
Mm-hmm.
And she played that, and then played that for a book party. And I had a novel called Under the Apple Tree that was republished a couple of years ago. And we had a party, and Sophie played that song from that era of World War II.
Has music always been a vibe? Because I've read New York in the 50s, and the jazz is almost a motif that runs through it, a connecting device.
You know, Norman Mailer once said jazz was the background music of the era of New York in the 50s. And it really was. I mean, there was the modern jazz quartet was very big, the cool jazz of Chet Baker and the West Coast people, and... it was just a great time for jazz, and that was very important to me. And in fact, the Modern Jazz Quartet had a record. No, this isn't Modern Jazz. I'm thinking of a Miles Davis recording called Sketches of Spain, and I used to play that all the time. And when I was writing the book, New York in the 50s. I played that over and over and over because it brought back the times for me. And I think music really evokes different eras in your life. And so it's been important to me as a writer.
New York in the 50s also has become kind of one of those eras in our cultural history that have passed into myth.
Yes.
You know, it's Paris in the 20s, to some degree the Harlem Renaissance now.
Yeah.
But New York in the 50s, because you had the Beats, obviously,
yeah.
Norman Mailer, all of the great jazz. And at that point also, you know, it was still one of the centers for a lot of live television.
Yeah.
You know, just this tremendous amount of creative energy. Is there any place like that now? Where that you could say at that moment it probably was the cultural center of the universe?
I don't know if there is one. I think it's much more scattered out, much more. I think in the old days, I remember there was a writer who was asked, well, do you have to live in New York to be a writer? And he paused a moment and said, well, at least for a while, and because all the connections mm-hmm. were there. I think now that's not necessarily the case at all. I think in a good way, writing and even film is more spread out. I mean, Austin, Texas is a big film center. I've been, you know, we made the movie of going all the way here.
Yeah.
And with great help from a wonderful woman named Jane Roulant, who was head of the Indiana Film Commission. And sadly, when Mitch Daniels became governor, one of his first acts was to abolish the Indiana Film Commission. So all the great films that were made here, like Hoosiers and A League of Their Own, Eight Men Out, are not being made here. And it was very sad that last year John Green's wonderful novel, The Fault in Our Stars, was not made in Indiana, and it was made in Pittsburgh, and they had to recreate scenes from Indiana. And
find places
Pittsburgh.
That weren't hilly.
Yeah, yeah. I know they recreated a part of the art museum here, at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and they recreated it in Pittsburgh. So I feel that's a real loss.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Hoosier writer Dan Wakefield about his life and career, what he's up to these days. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Will has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Will writes, Mr. Wakefield, what was Kurt Vonnegut's real feeling toward Indianapolis, Indiana? I had often heard that he could not wait to leave the Indianapolis, the small, narrow-minded people area.
Well, let me quote him, something he said to me that I've often thought about since I moved back. When I was living in Miami, I would go to New York a couple times a year, and I would always have lunch with Kurt. And I remember once walking back from lunch, just out of the blue, he turned to me and said, you know, Dan, we never had to leave Indianapolis to be writers because there are people there who are just as kind and just as mean, just as smart and just as dumb as people anywhere in the world. And I often think of that. And I think, for one thing, he married a woman from here, and I know they did not want to get involved in the social scene. She would have had to be in the junior league and so on, which a lot of people enjoy, but she didn't.
It was not her,
And they... They knew that he was interested in writing, and he he just felt that he needed to be away for a while, as I felt I did too.
Well, and I want to talk about that a little bit, because I think this is one of the things that, at the very least, is intriguing. I mean, Slaughterhouse-Five and Going All the Way came out fairly close to each other. They were published, both incredibly successful novels, bestsellers, and yet in different ways, they both kind of distanced you. both writers from the place they were, you know, for most cities, having two native sons write perhaps the two hottest books in the country at that time would be a real source of pride. That wasn't exactly the response you got, though, or he did either.
No, in fact, I've had the honor and pleasure of editing three books of his work. So the first one was the book of his Kurt Vonnegut letters. And I put in that book a letter he wrote to me at the time that Slaughterhouse came out. And he said, "Dear Dan, I've spent the afternoon at the Ellis Ayres bookstore," which was the big bookstore here at the time. And this was with Slaughterhouse Five. He said, "I have sold 11 copies, all of them to relatives, I swear to God." And you know, any place else in the country, there'd be lines out for two blocks to get his autograph. It was only almost till he, the year he died, that he was really fully recognized here and applauded. So maybe that will happen to me too.
Well, yeah, you had a similar experience with Going All the Way too.
Oh, right? Yeah, I had a in a way more concentrated attack. A lot of people thought they were in the novel, or they thought I had written ill of the city. And, you know, as I often said, that whole story could have taken place in Detroit or Cleveland, but I don't know anything about Detroit or Cleveland, and I know about Indianapolis, and I have always had a love for it. And you have to have that when you're writing about a place. You have to feel a real connection, I think. And and also, people to this day think that, oh, all of those things happened. You know, I mean, I have people come up to me and say, "God, that must have been amazing when you and Ted were kicked out of the Meridian Hills swimming pool because he had a beard." Well, nobody had a beard in those days. They would have been kicked out of the city, and not just the swimming pool. And so, you know, I guess the concept of fiction is hard to get across. And, you know, and this friend, Ted Stee, he was sort of the character of Gunner, was a model which I originated with Ted as a friend. And but we never had that summer in Indianapolis. We never did any of those things. I really got to know him when he came to New York.
Did it give you a sense of kinship? I mean, this is a kind of a classic American story, too. I mean, Sherwood Anderson wasn't really welcomed back to Clyde after Waynesburg, Ohio. Sinclair Lewis, Thomas Wolfe, there are all sorts of these stories where people write about their hometowns and in ways that the people there didn't welcome.
It's not just that. You know, when Amy Tan wrote her books, the Chinese-American community was upset.
So it is a recurring pattern in our cultural history. We are talking today with Hoosier writer, Indiana legend, Dan Wakefield, Uncle Dan of Uncle Dan's Story Hour, here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Again, we're talking with Dan Wakefield. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with Dan Wakefield, Hoosier writer of tremendous renown, also the host of Uncle Dan's Story Hour, and into many other ventures now. I want to talk a little bit about that, but I'd invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So we've talked about the performance coming up on June 12th at the Jazz Kitchen, right?
June 12th with Sophie Fott.
And so how did this sort of late career emergence as a kind of performance artist come about? Because you've done stuff
totally by accident. I was sitting at the Red Key Tavern, a favorite place of mine for a long time, and Mike Thurwichter, who did their website and took photographs there, and he said to me one night, Dan, I said to Jim Settle, the owner, Monday nights are kind of slow. Why don't we have Dan come in one Monday night a month, and we'll call it Writer's Night. And this came out of my head. I don't know how it got there, but my response was, no, we shouldn't call it Writer's Night because then people will want me to read their writing. Let's call it Uncle Dan's Story Hour. And I guess because people that I knew and met at the Red Key were always asking me, tell us about this or tell us about New York or something. So it just came out of my head. And then all these other things came out. And the other thing, as soon as I knew we were going to have a thing to try to be a radio program, I got Will Higgins of The Star to be the kind of host. And then the next thing I said, we need music, so let's get Sophie Fott. And she came and played. And I always said she was like the soul of the show. And she would play a song at the beginning, at the break, midtime break, and then at the end. And those were great. By the way, I should also say that my old friend from New York, the jazz musician David Amram, is coming May 11th. Yes, May 11th and May 10th. I'm going to do an interview with him, and then he's giving his big concert, which he did a year ago at the Jazz Kitchen also.
What is it you enjoy about performance? Because a lot of writers are almost shy away from that. They prefer to let the page speak for them.
Well, I think I've said honestly, I think because I'm a ham. The only A plus I ever got was in public speaking at Shortridge of C.C. Shoemaker. And I gave the graduation address at Shortridge, which in those days, it didn't go to the person with the best grades. It went to who a group of faculty decided you had to try out with the speech. And I won the tryout, so I got to give the address. And I thought I was being very, very clever and, original and all that. And I years later looked back and saw what I'd written for that. And the first line was, "Tonight we have reached a milestone in our lives." I thought, oh my God, that's the worst cliche anybody has ever had for a graduation speech. But anyway, so yeah, I guess I've always liked that.
We are talking with Dan Wakefield today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. or do what a listener named Charles has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Charles, you're on the air.
Hi. Uncle Dan, I just wanted to say I listen to you. I listen to John talk to you. I've listened to the advertisements for your programs. You are of my father's age. My dad's 92. And
I'm not that old.
He's a little younger than that.
A little younger, but the thing is that 1950, if you graduated from high school, then you're close to my dad's age. Not that old, but my point is that I'm impressed, and I'm happy to say that I don't have a very good opinion of a black guy. And my dad telling me things about being in there, Indianapolis in the 40s and 50s, I don't have a very good opinion of people of European descent of that age as far as them being open-minded. And you are a shining example of the kind of person that I know exists and existed in Indianapolis. But when I hear you talk about being around James Baldwin and these things, I'm really impressed. And I'm really kind of proud that, okay, there were people in Indianapolis during that time who were fine, upstanding, honorable men, and it didn't matter what their faces looked like, but they're fine and upstanding.
Well,
and
thanks
very much for the call, Charles. Let me give Dan a chance to respond. Thank you very much for sharing that story.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I have to say that I was not all that enlightened or aware in those days. And I really wasn't aware of black people in Indianapolis until Oscar Robertson came along, I think, which made a lot of people aware. And my friend Betsy Blankenbaker, who's from here, did a wonderful documentary called Something to Cheer about the Addicts team. That Addicts team was very important. And then later, WFYI did a recent documentary by Ted Green of Addicts, telling not only about Oscar and the sports heroes, but about people from Addicts in every area of life, lawyers, doctors, and one a general who was the commanding officer of Colin Powell. And so, you know, I feel like a woman I got to know, in fact, from Shortridge, so I consider her part of the Shortridge Mafia, Alida Hodge, just wrote a new book about Indiana Avenue, which was very, very enlightening to me. And so, by the way, I'm just for the record, I'm 80. I will be 86 next month.
Okay.
So, and I seem to be fully functional. So I'm very grateful. But it was, and I got to tell you another thing. That documentary that WFYI did called "Indy in the 50s." They asked everybody, what was it like when you were in high school to go downtown? And, you know, you're interviewed individually, so you don't know how it's going to be edited together.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first cut of that show, you see me saying, oh, my friends and I in high school, we loved to go downtown. That was a great thing. You'd get a date and go to the Circle Theater. The next cut is Oscar Robertson saying, we were afraid to go downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that. My friends and I didn't know that. This city was so... In fact, Vonnegut wrote in a talk he gave here to the Civil Liberties Union, he started out the talk saying that I grew up in a city that was just as segregated as Biloxi, Mississippi, except for the buses and the water fountains.
Yeah, he was... In the interest of full disclosure, I was the executive director of the Civil Liberties Union at the time he gave that talk. And I remember it clearly. The other line that is stuck in my head is he referred to Crispus Attucks High School as Innocent Bystander High School because of the way Crispus Attucks was killed. Was it weird coming back after all those years? I mean, yeah, time does not stand still. Places change. People change. And you had a long interlude.
Yeah. Well, I had come back I first came back after Going All the Way came out. I didn't come back for a long time except to see my parents under cover of night. But I started coming back. A woman, a wonderful woman named Ophelia Roop at the Central Library invited me to come back. I think it was in 87. And I said, well, you mean it's safe now? And she said, oh, we read Going All the Way in book clubs now. It's perfectly okay. So I came back at that time. And then I started coming. Jim Powell had started the Indiana Writers Center, and he would have me come and do workshops. Mm-hmm. And I started seeing old high school friends who I do have dinner every couple months with, a group of Shortridge friends from my class, and that's really a lot of fun. So it was, it's been good to be back and to be part of things that I also, I'm here, got a ride here with my friend John Myers, and he mm-hmm. and I took a workshop, a very important workshop here called Undoing Racism, which mm. was put on by the Child Advocates of Indianapolis. And so we are aware and hoping to see some changes. Changes are always very slow.
We are talking with Dan Wakefield on No Limits today. Wade, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Dan. Certainly. It's a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. My question was, I'll try to condense this. With the advent of the Internet, we have this kind of democratization of the word, of the written word. We have libraries changing. We have people saying that the printed word is dead, on paper, in book form, in newspaper form. And you have a democratization, a lot more people can express themselves via, blogging out there and putting things on the Internet. You also have a lot of kind of poorly trained writers and no real editorship out there. So can you kind of maybe speak to how maybe the Internet and the change from the printed word to the digital word changes how we communicate, and maybe how it changes for you and writers like yourself. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Wade.
Well, I'm not very good at it, and I having this website is my big advance, and I do a blog from the website, and I have a guy who runs it for me and who sends out tweets. I've sent out a few tweets, but he does them for me because I'm just not very adept at that. But, I think a lot of people have made more incisive comments than I could about that whole thing. It's true that I think Vonnegut wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and he said he was often people would meet him at cocktail parties and know that he had taught at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, and sort of said to him snidely, oh, can you really teach writing? And Vonnegut said, the value of these graduate schools now is that in the old days, editors and agents really taught you. They gave you, 3-page single spaced letters, how to improve a story. And that doesn't happen much anymore, if at all. And so graduate writing programs do what editors and agents used to do. And of course, here we have a great thing in the Indiana Writers Center, which now Barb Shoup runs, a writer herself, and they have just a great assortment of programs to help people know how to write in whatever vein they want to do it.
We've got just a couple of minutes left, but I want to ask, is the bulk of your writing now focused on the performance work, or do you have another book in the works? Or
Yeah, I'm pledging myself that I'll finish this summer a memoir about my goddaughter, who is a Cuban-American girl from Miami who I met in Miami when she was 4 years old, and she's now 22. And my great pleasure, she came and lived with me here a year while she went to Harrison College and did a program which enabled her to be certified as a veterinary assistant. And that was just great. And the wonderful thing was she got a part-time job at a wonderful place in Broderville called A Taste of Havana, which is a Cuban sandwich shop.
That became one of your favorite places to
eat,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the only places that in Broderville Avenue that's not a bar. So it's and they have really great food. And George, who's the owner, is a great guy. And I encourage anyone to try their food. You'll taste what it really is like to have Cuban sandwiches.
Just got a little bit of time left. The event on June 12th, again, is
the Uncle Dan and Sophie Jam at the Jazz Kitchen. And that's on the website, tickets on the website of the Jazz Kitchen.
What would the cost be to attend, cover charge?
I think it's going to be $25, and they have great food too.
So it'll be a night of jazz and stories, right?
And stories about Cole Porter.
Okay, well, that sounds like something that should not be missed. I'd like to thank you very much for this conversation, and thank you again for the help with the Richard Lugar documentary as well. Also, would like to remind our listeners that they should consider making their pledge to WFYI. You can do that by calling 1-800-233-0020, or you can go to wfyi.org/give. Please give until you feel good. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.